the Black family in American history, but specifically within the context of slavery, to demonstrate how Black families were able to endure, how they were able to withstand just a host of challenges externally. And of course, asking Heather Williams made a whole lot of sense, given the fact that this is just a remarkable expert on the period of slavery in particular. So this was, again, thinking about the current moment. We were really thinking about how do we connect past to the present, and that essay helps us contextualize the history and to see some of the challenges that remain even to this day, to see how it connects to the period of slavery, which, of course, Heather Williams explains in this text.
We want to thank you both so much for being with us. We haven't even talked about the audio version of this book, which is a magnificent extravaganza of a multitude of voices. Ibram X. Kendi and Keisha Blaine's new book. They are co-editors of 400 Souls, A Community History of African America, 1619 to 2019. And that does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Perk, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Naduro, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio. I'm Amy Goodwin-Gonzalez.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, indoor dining will resume in the metro area on Friday as Governor Brown decides to ease restrictions in high-risk areas. The CDC formally announces the practice of double masking can significantly increase protection against COVID-19, and former President Trump's impeachment trial continued earlier today with opening statements by the House impeachment managers. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 529 new COVID-19 cases on Tuesday, bringing the total in the state up to 147,932. 7 deaths were reported, bringing the state death toll to 2,031. Beginning Friday, restaurants and bars in Oregon's largest counties can resume indoor service, and gyms can greatly increase the number of members allowed inside. Because of an apparent decline in COVID-19 infections around the state, Oregon will move a dozen counties, including Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington, from the extreme risk to the high risk category. Under the state's rules, restaurants and gyms in counties classified as high risk can allow up to 50 people inside, or 25% capacity, whichever is smaller. Outdoor seating for restaurants will increase to 75 people. Despite this change in policy, health officials urge people to continue wearing masks, continue to physically distance themselves from others, and follow proper hand hygiene. 14 counties will remain in the extreme risk classification, including Marion, Lane, Benton, and Yamhill. In national COVID news, the CDC has found close-fitting surgical masks worn underneath cloth masks, commonly known as double masking, can significantly increase protection against COVID-19. The study found the most protective masks fit well around the face in order to, quote, prevent leakage of air around the mask's edges. The CDC also recommends knotting ear loops to contour the mask closer to the face. The study suggests that double masking can increase aerosol droplet protection by 90%. Aerosol droplets exhaled by individuals infected with COVID-19 are the primary way that the virus spreads. The CDC study compared wearing no mask, wearing a poorly fitted surgical mask, a cloth-only mask, and double masking in a simulation of respiratory droplets between two people. The study did not look at respirators like N95s, which most health authorities recommend be reserved for medical personnel. Dr. Anthony Fauci has in past briefings said the public should consider double masking, but this is the first CDC-backed research to recommend the practice. The findings do not apply to men with beards and facial hair, which can interfere with masks, or to children whose faces are smaller. Forecasters at the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation believe that if 95% of people wore masks in public, more than 100,000 lives could be saved by June 1st. The second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump continued today in Washington, D.C. Today marks the first of 2 days of opening statements by the House impeachment managers. This will be followed by up to 2 days of statements from Trump's legal team. Democratic Representative Madeline Dean from Pennsylvania was one of those who presented the case for impeachment at today's hearing.
He'd assembled thousands of violent people, people he knew were capable of violence, people he had seen be violent. They were standing now in front of him. And then he pointed to us, lit the fuse, and sent an angry mob to fight the perceived enemy, his own vice president and the members of Congress, as we certified an election.
But I said, something's wrong here. Something's really wrong. Can't have happened. And we fight. We fight like hell. And if you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. Our exciting adventures and boldest endeavors have not yet begun. My fellow Americans, for our movement, for our children, and for our beloved country, and I say this, despite all that's happened, the best is yet to come. So we're going to walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. I love Pennsylvania Avenue. And we're going to the Capitol, and we're going to try and give, you know, the Democrats are hopeless. They're never voting for anything, not even one vote. But we're going to try and give our Republicans, the weak ones, because the strong ones don't need any of our help. We're going to try and give them the kind of pride and boldness that they need to take back our country. So let's walk down Pennsylvania Avenue. I want to thank you all. God bless you, and God bless America. Thank you all for being here. This is incredible. Thank you very much.
Fight for Trump! Fight for Trump! Fight for Trump! Fight for Trump! Fight for Trump!
Are we here for?
If you don't fight like hell, you're not going to have a country anymore. And there was only one fight left, and it was a mile up the road. Donald Trump, the President of the United States, ordered the crowd to march on Congress, and so the crowd marched. This is incredible, you heard him say. That's how President Trump ended his speech. I'd like to close with a very brief timeline of what was happening in parallel alongside the president as he spoke on the 6th of January. A little after noon, President Trump began his speech with a fiery refusal to concede. He commanded the crowd to fight and march down Pennsylvania Avenue. And around 12:20, some rally-goers, some attendees, began marching. By 12:30, as President Trump continued to incite his supporters, large segments of the rally crowd had amassed at the Capitol. At 12:53, as the president's speech was playing on cell phone broadcasts, the outermost barricade of the northwest side of the Capitol was breached. And Capitol Police were forced back to the steps of the Capitol. At 1:10, the president ended his speech with a final call to fight and a final order to march to the Capitol. At 1:45, the president's followers surged past Capitol Police, shouting, "This is a revolution!" Just after 2:10, an hour after President Trump ended his speech, the insurrectionist mob overwhelmed Capitol security and made it inside the halls of Congress. Because the truth is, this attack never would have happened but for Donald Trump. And so they came, draped in Trump's flag, and used our flag, the American flag, to batter and to bludgeon. And at 2:30, I heard that terrifying banging on House chamber doors. For the first time in more than 200 years, the seat of our government was ransacked on our watch.
That was Representative Madeline Dean from Pennsylvania speaking at today's impeachment hearing for Donald Trump. House impeachment managers are focusing on demonstrating today the extent of the violence that occurred at the Capitol on January 6th. The hearing is set to continue tomorrow. With little GOP support, the U.S. Senate has deemed Trump's impeachment constitutional, moving the trial forward. With more on that story, it's Mary Sherman with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The yeas are 56, the nays are 44.
Former President Donald Trump's second impeachment trial opened yesterday with the Senate voting it to be constitutional. Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, who initially opposed the trial, switched positions, joining five other Republicans voting in favor. House impeachment manager Jamie Raskin shared a disturbing video of the January 6th insurrection, in which hundreds of Trump supporters stormed the Capitol. And he argued a president cannot get away with committing an impeachable offense in their last weeks of office.
History does not support a January exception in any way, so why would we invent one for the future?
Congressman Joe Neguse, another House impeachment manager, cited two historical examples of impeachment after office, which he said set a clear precedent.
What you experienced that day, what we experienced that day, what our country experienced that day, is the framers' worst nightmare come to life.
Trump's team denied those claims. One of his attorneys, Bruce Castor, argued opponents only want to use impeachment to bar Trump from future office.
President Trump no longer is in office. The object of the Constitution has been achieved. He was removed by the voters.
Another defense attorney, David Schoen, claimed the power of impeachment is being abused for political gain.
They want to put you through a 16-hour presentation over 2 days, focusing on this as if it were some sort of blood sport. And to what end? For healing? For unity? For accountability? Not for any of those.
House managers are expected to argue today Trump committed the high crime or misdemeanor of inciting an insurrection and must be held accountable. Trump's defense will follow, with a vote possible as early as the weekend. The Senate Homeland Security Committee heard testimony from Neera Tanden, the nominee for White House Budget Director. Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman questioned how Tanden plans to build relationships with members of Congress she's publicly attacked.
You wrote that Susan Collins is, quote, the worst, that Tom Cotton is a fraud, that vampires have more heart than Ted Cruz. You called Leader McConnell Moscow Mitch and Voldemort.
Tanden pledged the Office of Budget Management will be accountable to Congress and apologized.
The last 4 years or last few years have been pretty polarizing, and I hope that we can work to address the country's challenges in a bipartisan and nonpartisan manner.
Tanden served in both the Obama and Clinton administrations. And White House Health Equity Task Force Chair Dr. Marcella Nunez-Smith announced a new partnership with community health centers to reach underserved and vulnerable communities with more COVID-19 vaccines.
This includes people who are experiencing homelessness, you know, agricultural and migrant workers, residents of public housing, and those with limited English proficiency.
Weekly doses distributed to states will increase by about 5% to 11 million a week. For Pacific Network and Public News Service, I'm Mary Sherman. Thanks for listening.
Prosecutors in Fulton County, Georgia, are investigating Donald Trump's attempts to overturn the state's 2020 presidential election results. On January 2nd, Trump called Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, and pressured him to, quote, find 11,780 more votes for him, the exact number that would be needed to overturn Biden's victory.
So, look, all I want to do is this. I just want to find 11,780 votes, which is one more than we have, because we won the state, and flipping the state is a great testament to our country, because, you know, there's just it's a testament that they can admit to a mistake, or whatever you want to call it, if it was a mistake, I don't know.
Georgia statutes specifically state that it's a crime for anyone to solicit, request, or command another person to engage in election fraud. Georgia State University law professor Anthony Michael Kreis told Politico, quote, "The president asked in no uncertain terms the Secretary of State to invent votes, to create votes that weren't there." On Monday, Raffensperger's office opened its own investigation into Trump's phone calls, including an earlier call demanding he overturn the results based on unfounded claims of voter fraud. Trump also faces criminal and civil fraud investigations in New York, with an ongoing crime inquiry into his finances by the Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance and a civil investigation by the New York Attorney General Letitia James. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Noise Filter Debunking COVID-19. Then, news from the BOO at 5:45, your look at the news inside KBOO. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with light rain developing after midnight and a low of 34 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be light rain, followed by a mix of rain and snow in the afternoon and a high of 36. The Portland metro area will be under a winter storm watch starting Thursday at 12 p.m. and going until 10 a.m. on Saturday. Today in history, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed. The landmark civil rights and labor law outlaws discrimination based on race, gender, and sexual orientation. The quote of the day is from activist and philosopher Angela Davis, who said, quote, "Radical simply means grasping things at the root." Nation has administered nearly all of its COVID-19 vaccines and is now awaiting a shipment of both shots and personnel to help administer more. With that story and others, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation has administered 98% of its current COVID-19 vaccine doses as the tribe receives additional vaccines and personnel this week to help administer more. As of Tuesday, the Navajo Area Indian Health Service had vaccinated more than 77,000 people from its supply of 78,520 vaccines. The Navajo Nation is set to receive more than 28,900 additional doses and clinical staff to help with vaccinations. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez talked about the tribe's vaccination plan during a virtual town hall Tuesday.
Our goal, ladies and gentlemen, is to give 100,000 shots to our Navajo people by the end of February. February is a short month, 28 days, and that's our goal for this month.
More than 170,000 Navajo citizens reside on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. Healthcare officials say Navajo citizens who live off the reservation are getting vaccinated when they return to their home communities. The Navajo Nation's additional support is in part due to hundreds of millions of federal dollars recently allocated to the Indian Health Service to assist with COVID-19 testing and vaccination efforts across Indian country. A Native American legislator in Wyoming says Congresswoman Deb Haaland has broad support among indigenous people in her state to lead the Department of the Interior, as a number of U.S. Republican lawmakers are publicly opposing Haaland's nomination, concerned about resource development, citing Haaland's support of environmental policies. Representative Andy Clifford, Northern Arapaho, says if U.S. Senator John Barrasso of Wyoming opposes Haaland's nomination with a no vote, that would damage his relationship with indigenous constituents.
You know, her nomination brings attention to the fact that she, as one of the first indigenous female U.S. representatives, faces systemic racism, you know. And our Senator Barrasso, he has to do a better job of ensuring that everyone has the opportunity to participate in our democracy.
People across Indian country have expressed their excitement about the possibility of having a Native American as Secretary of the Interior.
What I see is happening is that more indigenous people are becoming engaged and participating in processes that we've never been welcomed to participate in the past. And to me, that'll always be a step in the right direction. So when we're getting more diverse representation at the table, people get uncomfortable with that.
Barrasso has indicated he may vote against Haaland's confirmation, while Montana Senator Steve Daines has announced his intention to block her confirmation. Both Republican senators sit on the Committee on Energy and Natural Resources, which will take up the confirmation.
We run for our sisters!
The Standing Rock Youth Council hosted a run Tuesday to urge President Biden to shut down the Dakota Access Pipeline. They posted updates throughout the day on social media. Lakota youth journeyed 93 miles to the site of the No Dapple resistance camps 4 years ago along the Cannonball River in North Dakota. People across the country showed their support to the youth by running in solidarity, sharing photos and videos on social media. Oil pipeline opponents are hopeful after Biden halted the Keystone XL pipeline. Opponents fighting a pipeline replacement project in Minnesota are urging the administration to stop construction of Line 3. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
President Biden's executive order to end the use of private prisons is an important first step, but doesn't apply to the tens of thousands of people held in ICE facilities across the country. Andrea Sears with the Public News Service has more on the story.
Immigrant advocates say President Joe Biden's executive order to end the use of private prisons is an important first step, but more needs to be done. The executive order issued during the first week of Biden's presidency directs the Department of Justice not to renew its contracts with corporations operating the privately run prisons that house about 16% of the federal prison population. But according to Besma Eid with the group Freedom to Thrive, it does not apply to contracts under Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, which held an average of 50,000 undocumented immigrants in detention every day in fiscal year 2019, 80% of them in privately owned or managed prisons.
While this executive order does take a step towards abolishing the use of for-profit prisons, it really doesn't speak to the number of immigrants who are detained in these privately run facilities.
During his presidential campaign, Biden pledged to end the federal use of private prisons, including for the detention of undocumented immigrants. The COVID pandemic adds another layer of urgency to the need to end the mass detention of immigrants. Eid points out that infections are extremely difficult to control in congregate settings, including in detention facilities.
There's been numbers of outbreaks that have happened across the country, and instead of releasing people and protecting them and letting them be home with their families and their communities, people are risking their lives every day inside.
In November, at least five people detained at a privately run ICE detention facility in New Jersey tested positive for COVID-19. Eid notes that the Obama administration had issued an executive order to curtail federal use of private prisons, but that also did not address immigration detentions, and it was quickly overturned by the Trump administration.
These executive orders can only last as long as that executive is in power. And so 4 years from now, depending on who is in the White House, can really dictate how impactful these orders really will be.
She says detention of undocumented immigrants can be ended by abolishing ICE and adopting comprehensive immigration reform, including a pathway to citizenship. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael had just a taste of impeachment.
In yesterday's impeachment hearing, Trump's lawyer threatened current representatives and senators with defeat, threatened remaining Democrats with impeachment, and stirred up the seditionist base with threats on Donnie's freedom to bring people to the point of insurrection and murder, because he didn't tell them to do it, only that it needed to be done and they were special. I had hopes February would be boring. I want Trump penniless. I want full investigation and prosecution, and Trump and his enablers from Fox to Jared and Marco. I trust Biden and the Dems can multitask, impeaching Donnie while reversing his deeds, getting people back to work and spending their wages, changing the national priorities from profit for a few to sustainability for all, that what we share is so much more important than how corporations want to divide us, divert us from forcing the wealthy and powerful to pay their fair share. Meanwhile, Palm Beach has told Trump he can't live at Mar-a-Lago, and here in Portland, there's crocuses all over. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
A bill targeting transgender athletes in North Dakota is advancing through the state legislature. Mike Moen has more.
A North Dakota legislative committee has approved a measure that LGBTQ advocates say unfairly targets transgender athletes. Bill supporters say they don't want unfair competition in team sports. This week, the House Human Services Committee advanced a proposal that effectively bars public high school athletes who identify as transgender from participating in team sports that don't align with the sex on their birth certificate. Bill's sponsors say it can especially protect female athletes so they wouldn't have to face competition from athletes born as males. But Brandy Hardy of the North Dakota Human Rights Coalition says that argument is counterproductive.
I think that it's egregious to stand behind one movement to push forward hate towards another group of people.
Other opponents say this will push transgender athletes further away from their fellow students while making it harder for them to decide which activities to sign up for. Similar legislation has surfaced in other states in recent years. The North Dakota bill has some amendments, including removing language for college sports, over concerns the law would result in regional schools losing out on hosting events. Representative Mary Schneider is a Democrat from Fargo who sits on the Human Services Committee. She voted against the measure, saying it's a solution in search of a problem.
Girls don't need this protection. They don't want this protection. They didn't testify for this protection.
She says the only thing it would do is create an image problem for the state when it comes to discrimination. The association that governs high school sports in North Dakota has rules that allow transgender students to sign up for activities under their identifying gender with certain restrictions. Transgender advocates say the state should adopt those rules to eliminate any confusion. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
Groups in California say last summer's blackouts were unnecessary, and they're urging a deeper probe into what happened. Suzanne Potter with the Public News Service has the story.
The California Public Utilities Commission meets tomorrow to vote on contracts for more power generation to avoid a repeat of last summer's blackouts. But clean energy groups are saying it's unclear how much energy we need because they feel the state's explanations for the outages are insufficient. The California Independent System Operator, known as CAISO, blamed the blackouts primarily on excessive heat, breakdowns at power plants, and software issues. But Loretta Lynch, former head of the California Public Utilities Commission, says there's more to the story.
It may well be that defects in California's electricity market design and in its operations have allowed for trading strategies that created artificial supply shortages, and that those caused last summer's blackouts.
Some fear a repeat of the energy crisis of 2000, when oil companies managed to manipulate the state's electricity market, costing billions. Data show that last August, huge price spikes rocked the California energy market, sending it shooting up from $40 to $1,000 per megawatt hour. Rick Humphreys is a retired engineer and an expert in root cause analysis. He says consumers are stuck with the bill.
It's well over $1 billion of cost that's going to get passed on to the ratepayers in CAISO, and that's at wholesale.
The agency admits that a software glitch allowed energy to be exported to other states during California's greatest hour of need. Humphreys says that's what put California over the edge.
There's lots of excess capacity in the state of California. If it hadn't been for the exports, there would have been no blackouts.
CAISO's policy is to hold back reserve power in case a nuclear plant goes down, and this was not changed even during the blackouts when three natural gas-powered plants went offline. Retired public interest lawyer Bill Julian wants lawmakers to force CAISO and the Public Utilities Commission to dig deeper.
We have a troubling pattern of forced outages and power plant unavailability that strains supplies and requires investigation.
Advocates also want the PUC to require SoCal Edison, Pacific Gas and Electric, and San Diego Gas and Electric to share data from smart meters with local governments that have community choice energy programs. The idea is that with better information on usage, CAISO might be able to avoid unnecessary blackouts. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
A proposed Indiana park plans to turn floodwaters into an attraction. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As extreme storms grow more common, the Ohio River is expected to spill over its banks more often and flood nearby areas. But rather than close down during a flood, a new park in southern Indiana will make the best of high water.
Our pivot is, okay, lean into climate change, lean into a wetter landscape. We want to be the park that people visit in flood.
That's Scott Martin of River Heritage Conservancy. The nonprofit is working to transform 600 acres along the Ohio River into connected green spaces that will be known as Origin Park. During dry weather, people will be able to walk and bike along the river's edge. But during a flood...
You now go kayaking and paddleboard through these wet woods. Above you will be a series of elevated pathways. Those pathways will still allow bikers to move through and walkers, but suddenly they will be over on top of water that will have paddlers in it.
Martin's group has already raised $10 million for the project, and about 300 acres have been acquired or set aside. The entire park will take about 20 years to complete, but sections will be done sooner. When finished, it will connect people with their changing natural environment for generations to come. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 10th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Jenka Soderberg, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonio Gonzalez, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, Mary Sherman, and Andrea Sears. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for COVID Noise Filter, debunking the coronavirus pandemic.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
Vaccine in the Cherokee Nation. Now, the vaccine is not only used to save us from COVID-19, but also save the Cherokee Nation's language. Not even 2,000 people are fluent in the Cherokee language, and this number continues to decrease due to COVID. The Cherokee Nation has done relatively better at controlling the virus spread. Out of 12,300 cases, 69 have died, and 30 of them were native speakers. The tribal government decided that identified Cherokee speakers will be among the first to receive the vaccine after frontline healthcare workers to preserve the language until it can be passed down. Now, how cool is that? The principal chief took office prioritizing preservation of the language and now is emphasizing it. The tribe wants to ensure the survival of life, but also culture and identity. Over 600 speakers have been vaccinated, and along with the speakers, the Cherokee are prioritizing the elderly, which is building more trust in the vaccine. Many people, including the fluent speakers, find honor and responsibility in getting the vaccine to help preserve the culture. Language is a particularly important part of any culture, so hopefully with the push of vaccines on fluent speakers, the Cherokee people can achieve their goals. And yes, we are so grateful for that. And the preservation of language is incredibly important. And we're so happy to hear that. Navigating dating during the COVID-19 pandemic. So it's no surprise that finding a relationship partner has become harder during the pandemic. Since we have limited contact with other people and we usually spend our time around the ones we're closest to, it's not so easy to meet new people. But chatting up a stranger at a bar truly sounds like a thing of the past. So how do we meet people? Now, this is a question that many Americans have faced through the pandemic. People's feelings of loneliness have been compounding for close to a year now. Dating apps like Tinder and Hinge and Bumble, they're all great to get the ball rolling. But once you meet someone online, how do you go about meeting them in person during a pandemic? Socially distanced meetups and masked encounters don't really sound ideal for a budding relationship, or they don't certainly scream romance, but it's the reality we're faced with in this new COVID normal. Now, as the New York Times put it in their article, true stories of hooking up during COVID-19. New world, new rules, same old problems. People have begun to calculate the risk of meeting up with a stranger. This longing for contact with another person has driven some to consider the risk of COVID-19 exposure versus the reward of meeting up with a potential partner. For now, the safest way to develop a relationship is virtually or socially distanced by using FaceTime, texting, Zoom, or just socially distanced walks or meetups. It's not ideal by any means, but it's the safest way to develop a relationship. And once you feel it's time to take it to the next level, having one partner and an in-person contact with just them may be a safe way to mitigate unnecessary exposures. And hopefully soon we can go back to trying to find new partners at bars or arcades or wherever you search for that one. And yes, you could tell I've been married for a long time, because do even people go to arcades anymore? I don't know. How Dr. Fauci's experiences with the HIV/AIDS epidemic helped him deal with the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, throughout the pandemic, Dr. Anthony Fauci has become a prominent figure in everybody's life, regardless of their profession or orientation with healthcare and public health. Dr. Fauci has been a crucial navigator throughout the COVID-19 pandemic for the American public. And I also may add that, yes, he has made infectious diseases doctors cool again. Well, it may be strange to think about Dr. Fauci outside of the context of COVID-19, especially for those who aren't very well acquainted with the public health profession. But Dr. Fauci has had a long, trying, and successful career for many years before the pandemic dealing with other public health concerns. Dr. Fauci worked with the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a division of the National Institutes for Health, in Bethesda, Maryland. His contributions to various projects had outstanding results. He helped develop treatments for diseases that were once fatal and went on to have great outcomes and high rates of remission, including a form of vasculitis, which is an autoimmune disease. In the 1980s, Dr. Fauci was an integral piece of research treating HIV when little known was about the virus. Dr. Fauci recalled a 15-year period where there was no effective treatments for HIV, and unfortunately, many of our patients died. But Dr. Fauci went on to take the top position at the National Institutes for Health. He used his position to heavily advocate for NIH funding and to support research in HIV. Dr. Fauci found innovative ways to work with HIV activists and facilitate productive partnerships. Dr. Fauci's experience working in research to treat people living with HIV did prime him to handle the COVID-19 vaccine. Specifically, facing many issues of uncertainty about the virus and lack of information in the early stages and not having highly effective or specific treatments available, his experiences have made him a perfect candidate to navigate the U.S. during the COVID-19 pandemic. And Dr. Fauci, we would love to have you on the show. We know that you listen to this show. No, we don't, but we pretend that you do. We know that you listen to the show. We would love to have you call in. We would love to have you join us on air. And we would love to actually read that story for you. And as somebody who's been an HIV doctor for the past 20 plus years, I just want to say thank you for all your work. Singapore's universities enact rigorous and successful COVID containment programs. Now, college campuses across the U.S. are hotspots for contracting and transmitting COVID-19, greatly exceeding the threshold of transmission of public health organizations used to designate a community as a high risk. Campuses in the nation also have a higher chance of becoming super spreaders, putting whole communities at risk. And Singapore, on the other hand, has not seen cases of contraction at any of its three major universities. Huh. I wonder why. I bet you we're going to find out in a moment. This is because they've implemented a three-point COVID-19 management strategy. The National University of Singapore describes the strategy as containment, decongestion, and contact tracing. By containment, the university means that the campus was divided into five zones, and staff and students were assigned to a zone in which they must remain. To decrease the congestion, the universities established a hybrid learning program to minimize the number of people on campus and created a business continuity plan for employees. The president of the university says that the campus is at no more than 60% capacity at all times. Now, they also decreased congestion by monitoring high traffic areas such as the cafeteria. Now, if it's crowded, they do send out an advisory on their University Safe app to encourage those on campus to avoid it. The university also offers free food delivery to curb cafeteria attendance. The University Safe app is also used to report temperatures twice a day and conduct contact tracing, and students must be cleared in the app to board buses and buy food. Wow, I am so jealous of Singapore. That is amazing. All right, now Singapore's government has had a much more rigorous pandemic response program. Yes, I can definitely see that. Providing free testing and medical care to all citizens and long-term residents. They also enacted penalties for violating pandemic restrictions, such as revoking work passes. This is amazing. I love this story, and I hope that we could at some point maybe follow in those footsteps. Moderna's success with COVID-19 vaccines lead to the development of other vaccines. So, the ability of the COVID-19 vaccine to be developed so quickly is largely thanks to the platform it uses. The platform for the COVID-19 uses a messenger RNA, or we'll refer to it as mRNA, to create a desired protein in the host, and the development of an mRNA vaccine has been in the works for a long time. See, years of research and development gave vaccine developers the opportunity to utilize this technology. With the extreme successes of the COVID-19 vaccine, developers are inspired to continue developing vaccines with the same mRNA platform. Now, in particular, the pharmaceutical company Moderna, now remember, think about Moderna. It has an M as the first letter and RNA as the last three letters, they actually tell you in the name how they use their vaccine, Moderna. Now, which at this time is one of the two approved COVID-19 vaccine manufacturers in the US and is inspired to find other uses for the mRNA vaccine. So, recently Moderna announced that it'll be initiating a campaign to create a seasonal flu vaccine, a Nipah virus vaccine, and, dream with me, an HIV vaccine. Research for an HIV vaccine has been ongoing since 1987, and the development of an HIV vaccine would be game-changing. Currently, HIV is the cause of about 700,000 deaths worldwide annually. Unfortunately, development of an HIV vaccine, even with the same mRNA platform, will not be as rapid as the development of a COVID-19 vaccine. It will still take years before an HIV vaccine is available to the public. That's largely because it takes a while to develop HIV as opposed to developing coronavirus, especially in the middle of a pandemic. But the mRNA platform may be still close to producing a viable vaccine. Moderna did receive an investment from the Gates Foundation that helped them take two HIV vaccine candidates to early phases of trials this year, and that's great news. Moderna has also announced they're conducting early stage research for vaccines, including the Zika virus as well as the H7N9 influenza vaccine as well. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Derry and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at DRDERY. You can follow us at NoiseFilter on Instagram, NoiseFilterNola on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to NoiseFilterShow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving, and remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.